This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This is the BBC.
And this is from our own correspondent. With a Malaysian meal, a flute of champagne and a squadron of flying foxes, this edition was broadcast on Radio 4 on Saturday, June the 3rd. Here's Kate Adie.
Hello. Today, we hear of a former presidential candidate on trial and opposition figures arrested. Dissent is ever more dangerous in Egypt. In Kuala Lumpur, they love towering skyscrapers, all steel and glass, a view not shared in a traditional Malay village. Lovely weather for a party. We propose a toast to the doyen of French champagne. And would you want to protect the megabat? Squadrons of them. Piercing cacophony of shrieks and a lingering stench. Some Australians would like to get rid of them. The protest against the killing of young black Americans by the police has the rallying cry, Black Lives Matter. It's now being scrawled across monuments to the Confederate troops who were defeated in the US Civil War. Several cities have already removed statues commemorating the pro-slavery rebellion. And the mayors of Baltimore and St. Louis want their cities to follow suit. They face opposition and accusations of destroying cultural heritage. And in Alabama, there are attempts to make it illegal to remove or rename monuments that have been in place for more than 40 years. How much do statues and memorials matter? Asks our correspondent Aleem Makbul.
At 2 o'clock in the morning at the base of a statue, I'll admit I never really noticed on my many trips to New Orleans, a group of a dozen or so protesters had gathered, many draped in or waving Confederate flags. Young people were shouting abuse at them from a nearby bar. Some even came across to confront them at the monument. It was a statue of a man after whom parks, roads and schools are named all over the southern part of this country. Jefferson Davis was the Confederate president during the Civil War and a defiant defender of slavery. After many years of debate and legal process, the New Orleans Council decided to take down this monument. Those draped in flags came out every night to try to stop that happening. They're destroying a piece of Southern culture, one man told me. Another protester insisted these were good people. They lived and died for a reason. Why should we forget that? But a few nights later, a crane lifted Jefferson Davis up off his pedestal, his body gently spinning around, his outstretched arm sweeping from left to right as he disappeared into the back of a truck. In covering America's race problems, I'm always asking myself what the solution might be. Chanting Black Lives Matter is one thing, but what tangible step forward could demonstrators demand to bring about racial equality here? A couple of years ago in Alabama, as I worked on pieces to mark the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's march from Selma to Montgomery, I asked one of the most respected African-American civil rights voices of today, lawyer Brian Stevenson. His one-word answer surprised me. Monuments, he said. Not police body cameras, not a specific change in the criminal justice or education system. A man who'd thought about this question for decades told me monuments or what America needed to address to move forward on race. In America, we have monuments and markers all over about the Confederacy, he said. We have very few that talk about slavery or the terror era. The more I traveled, the more I saw how right he was. But how is changing that going to address the terrible, practical racial disparities I'd also seen? I've reported from Ferguson, where the unarmed black teenager Michael Brown was shot dead by a police officer, his body left on the street for hours in the summer heat. I'd seen the confrontations between police and Black Lives Matter protesters there and in Baltimore and South Carolina and many other places. Would replacing statues really help stop that? And in Alabama, an education official told me there was more segregation now in schools than 40 years ago. I interviewed Tylisa Black, an African-American mother who decided to send her young daughter, Shania, to a previously all-white school because of its good results. But a couple of weeks later, there was an emergency parents meeting where Tylisa describes her shock at seeing white parents shouting at the board, threatening to withdraw their children, saying those in charge had ruined the school's heritage by admitting a black pupil. Beside Tylisa's home, there was graffiti depicting her daughter Shania being hung from a tree. Would removing Confederate monuments have prevented that? Civil rights lawyer Brian Stevenson and many others believe that yes, eventually it could help change things. But they're talking about more than statues. They're talking about narrative. Bringing down Confederate statues across the South is the obvious bit. Many were put up specifically to taunt African Americans after slavery was abolished. There are very few monuments to mark the sites of old slave markets or the ports to which shackled men and women were brought. And from later decades, nearly 4,000 sites where black people were lynched go entirely unmarked. It's about even more than that. In many places in the US, schools can teach history however they want, so some students learn about the Civil War without mention of it being a fight over whether or not slavery was abolished. But why does it matter? In New Orleans, to cover the removal of monuments, I was working with a colleague, Franz, who's originally from Germany. We've talked a lot about how extensively he was taught about the Holocaust at school. He remembers going to a football match aged 15 and wondering whether he should even be proud to sing the national anthem, so ashamed was he of what he'd learnt. Germany was only able to move forward when it was brutally honest about its past. That is still an issue for the whole of America, not just its southern states.
Ali Makboul. The Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi signed a new law this week restricting the way non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, can operate. There is some support for the law in the belief that it'll safeguard national security in a country regularly targeted in terror attacks. But there's also been widespread condemnation at home and abroad. In America, three Republican senators described it as part of a growing crackdown on human rights and dissent under the president. Orla Guerin's been following developments.
For journalists of the old school, there are certain tools of the trade: notebooks, pens, and stacks of newspaper clippings. We tend to like keeping files on running stories. Being based in Cairo, one of my files is marked Repression. After 3.5 years in the Egyptian capital, that particular folder is bulging. The authorities here say they are fighting terrorism and organizations that destabilize the country. And there's no doubt that Egypt is under sustained attack from the so-called Islamic State. But critics say President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is using his war on terror as a license to crush dissent. Here are a few of the latest developments. A prominent lawyer and former presidential candidate, Khaled Ali, has gone on trial. What offence was grave enough to see him in the dock? Well, he's accused of making a rude hand gesture outside a Cairo courthouse. If convicted, conveniently enough, he will be disqualified from running in next year's presidential poll. About 30 other opposition figures have also been arrested recently. Activists say it's a preemptive strike aimed at scaring off anyone who might want to stand against President Sisi. News of Mr. Ali's arrest was reported by an independent website called Madam Masser, but its fearless journalism is no longer available online. It's one of more than 20 news websites which have been blocked, allegedly for supporting terrorism. The list includes one of Egypt's most prominent financial newspapers and the website of the Al Jazeera TV channel. The Egyptian leader followed all that with the signing of a new law imposing stringent controls on the operation and funding of non-governmental organizations. Among other things, they will no longer be allowed to carry out research or publish findings without permission from the state. Anyone breaking the law could face 5 years in jail. Mohamed Zahra is one of those who will have to grapple with the new restrictions, assuming he stays out of prison long enough. When we meet, he apologises for not giving me his business card. "It has the name of my organisation on it," he says, "and that's a crime." He's only half joking. The clean-shaven 36-year-old law graduate works for the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies. With his polo shirt and fashionable dark-rimmed glasses, he makes for an unlikely outlaw. But in fluent and forceful English, he explains that this is how he feels. From time to time, I have to check I'm not being followed, he says. And when I make calls, I have to use secure methods. The government makes us feel like criminals, like drug dealers. Mohamed Zahra is one of several activists who have been charged with receiving foreign funding to harm national security. The case dates back to 2011. I'm already banned from travelling abroad, he says, though they haven't seized my assets. Yet. He tells me that many of those he knows who have been working for change in Egypt are in exile, in jail, or waiting to go to jail. I ask what sentence he himself could face if convicted. He replies, calmly, life. While repression is not new in Egypt, activists insist it has escalated dramatically since the former leader, Hosni Mubarak, was swept away in the tumult of 2011. Mubarak wanted to restrict the space for civil society, says Mohamed Zahra, but Sisi wants to eliminate it. We now have no room for manoeuvre. Some campaigners here believe their only hope lies in pressure from the international community, but these days there isn't much of that, least of all from the White House, where President Sisi has a new ally. He and Donald Trump have bonded over security issues, both vowing that they will wipe out the extremists of Islamic State. Their mutual admiration went a step further when they met in Saudi Arabia recently, President Trump even praising the Egyptian leader's footwear. Love those shoes, he said. Boy, those shoes. Campaigners and activists have a very different view. They say President Sisi is trampling human rights underfoot. Now Donald Trump has given him such a free hand. I asked Mohamed Zahra what kind of future he expects for Egypt, where he is raising two girls, aged 4 and 7. This era will be history, he said. It will be history. I don't know when. I hope in my lifetime. If not, then in the lifetime of my daughters.
Orla Guerin. To Malaysia and its capital, Kuala Lumpur. What began as a miners' camp set up by Chinese and Malay tin prospectors in the mid-19th century is now the cultural, commercial and financial centre of the country. Today, mosques, churches, Hindu shrines and Buddhist temples can be found next to glistening, massive shopping centres. Grand British colonial buildings are now dwarfed by high-rise towers or rising in a sea of plastic chairs clustered round street food stalls. A city of contrast and diversity is how the local tourist board describes it. But for how much longer will that be true, asks Rob Crossan.
Skyscrapers are, by their very nature, pretty good at looming over human beings. But rarely has a skyscraper loomed quite so portentously as the one casting a shadow over my plate of nasi lemak. This, for the uninitiated, is to Malaysians what tostadas are to Mexicans and what asado is to Argentinians. In other words, a de facto national dish. Conversations about where the best version can be found tend to be both exhaustive and endless. Joining me on my tiny wooden table, clutching another plate of fried anchovies, coconut-infused rice, fried egg, peanuts, and a fiery sambal sauce, this is the classic, unadorned nasi lemak, is a man who introduces himself as Jamil. Little do I know the invective that is soon to be unleashed when I ask him the seemingly innocuous question of where he lives. "That is my house, right there," he gestures, swooping his chopsticks towards a dishevelled, yet utterly charming-looking clapboard house, smothered in foliage and with a cat sleeping near its crooked wire-mesh front gate. "They keep coming and offering me money, but I don't want it. I'm nearly 80 years old. What would I do with it?" Jamil's home is in one of Asia's most incongruous neighbourhoods, a genuine Malay village, marooned in the middle of some of the continent's most valuable real estate, right in the heart of Kuala Lumpur. Officially listed as a Malay agricultural settlement by the British in 1900, Kampung Baru was first established to attract rural Malays to the area at a time when Kuala Lumpur was a barely developed backwater at the confluence of two rivers. As the city developed at breakneck speed after independence in 1957, the village remained as it always had, the tiny lots of land having been passed down through generations of Malay families, few of whom have been tempted to sell. Today, the steel and glass behemoths of the Petronas Towers, the largest twin towers on the planet, along with the forest of other skyscrapers, seem to be almost snapping at the heels of the narrow lanes, tiny canvas-covered street food stands, wooden cottages and sagging telegraph poles of Kampung Bahru. Jamil may be fiercely protective of his family home, but rumours of the neighbourhood's threatened demise may not be overstated. This wonderfully eccentric oddity, the equivalent of finding an Appalachian log cabin settlement in the middle of Manhattan, is not what the Malaysian government have in mind for their 21st century capital city. A detailed development master plan was released last year, complete with pictures showing what, if enacted, the area will look like in 20 years' time. A giant Ferris wheel, elevated walkways, 30 million square feet of office space, 2,000 hotel rooms, and, in a detail that has been widely interpreted as tokenism by locals, an arts and crafts centre. It is a wake-up call for residents, the chairman of the Kampung Bahru Development Corporation, Datuk Effendi Zahari, warned in a recent interview. "Trust me," he added, "you do not want to get left behind." The Byzantium complexity that lies in store for the government in buying up the thousands of privately owned plots of land is being addressed through a coalition process. Locals are being encouraged to join together to sell their land collectively. According to Jamil, however, at least 60% of landowners aren't interested. "They hold these clinics for locals," Jamil tells me, as the tables around us fill up with regulars clutching heaving plates of chicken wings, rice and cuttlefish. "My neighbour told me that the government will never get to the bottom of it. There are over 1,000 plots of land here, which have passed through 4 or 5 generations. That means there are tens of rightful heirs to each plot of land. It's a maze. They can't succeed." But with rumours that land in Kampung Bahru is being valued at £200 per square foot, one wonders how many other locals will retain the intransigence of Jamil. As the sun slowly starts to sink, marking the end of another typically humid day in Kuala Lumpur, the lights of the Petronas Towers come on, their bulbs winking like a giant jewellery box across the city skyline. In our food court, the power supply fizzles, cuts out, and then the lights come back on, at about half their previous power. How much longer, I wonder, before the lights in Kampung Bahru, as we know it, go out for good.
Rob Crossan. Seen a fox lately? More likely, yes, if you live in a city these days. Vermin, chicken killer, lovable rogue, natural wildlife. The argument divides and persists. Man's relationship with wildlife in Australia is not without dispute either. This time it's flying foxes, the mega bat, that is. Noisy, stinky, and possibly bringing disease to the suburbs. But a species threatened by loss of habitat and lack of food. The residents of Sydney are getting new neighbours, and they're not happy, as Phil Mercer explains.
Silhouetted at twilight, they soar like ghosts on the wind. Sometimes there are just one or two, while others rise in gothic squadrons. With wingspans of up to a metre, flying foxes are a spectacular sight in eastern Australia when they take to the skies in search of food, often travelling long distances on their nocturnal missions. But Australia's megabats are in decline. Conservationists estimate that both the grey-headed flying fox and its spectacled cousin have declined by at least 95% in the past century. A summer heatwave this year has killed an unknown number of young bats, while many other factors conspire against those that remain. They include loss of habitat through land clearing, starvation, illegal shooting by farmers, and other man-made hazards such as power lines and barbed wire. The pressure is forcing more of these animals to set up camp in towns and cities, where the welcome isn't always warm. A large and boisterous colony of grey-headed flying foxes arrived in the Sydney suburb of Balgowlah in 2010. At dusk, they take to the skies, and while they may be a protected species, Ron Hoban, who lives nearby, wants them to leave. He complains of having to close his windows to a terrible stench that lingers in the breeze. Then there's the noise of up to 9,000 excitable bats, which leave at sunset to forage for nectar, pollen and fruits and return before sunrise. Their piercing cacophony of cries and squeals is, according to Ron and his long-suffering neighbours, an unwelcome punctuation to a good night's sleep. Loud blasts of Justin Bieber have been suggested as a way to get rid of unwanted colonies, along with smoke and flashing lights. But it wasn't the Canadian crooner who managed to dislodge a large camp of bats from Sydney's Royal Botanic Garden, but loud crashes, similar to a bin lorry doing its rounds, which were pumped out of speakers mounted on a golf buggy. Ecologists were worried that 35,000 grey-headed flying foxes were stripping trees of vegetation, slowly killing parts of the garden's world-famous collection. The bang-and-crash approach worked, and within a few days the bats had had enough. They flew away and didn't return. Evicting them is one thing, but it often simply creates a problem for someone else. Studies suggest that if a colony has moved on, it will simply re-establish itself nearby to be close to sources of food. There are four mainland types of flying fox, the black and grey-headed variety, along with the spectacled and little red. There are fears they're being pushed ever closer to extinction. Australia even has a threatened species commissioner who says this vast nation has the highest loss of mammals anywhere in the world. This is a country rightly proud of its biodiversity, even though it's under threat. The various perils it faces have galvanised a dedicated army of scientists, the government, green groups and volunteers. Take the screeching Tasmanian devil, for instance. It's being nurtured in zoos and wildlife parks as a facial tumour destroys those left in the wild. An insurance population is being raised. But Australia is increasingly being caught between environmental imperative and economic necessity. It's a dilemma that affects the health of the Great Barrier Reef. Industrialisation along the coast of Queensland and the exporting of coal from expanded ports generate jobs and revenue. But at what cost to the wildlife wonderland, which exists on the only living thing that can be seen from space? Climate change is another conundrum. Most Australians understand that rising temperatures are likely to inflict more severe droughts, floods, storms and bushfires, but this is a country still addicted to cheap supplies of coal that generate the bulk of its electricity, while millions of tons are sold to Japan and China. Man is mostly responsible for the decline of the megabats, and their survival is a test of Australia's true tolerance of its endangered native fauna and flora. While we marvel at their presence in the dark skies, do we want them causing a nuisance in our back gardens and suburban parks? The flying foxes carry the Australian bat lyssavirus, a disease related to rabies. Infections, though, are extremely rare. They may be unwanted and despised by some, but these intriguing mammals are valuable environmental couriers. The food they eat makes them one of the most efficient pollinators and seed dispersers of native forest trees in Australia. Like them or not, they're a vital part of the landscape here.
Phil Mercer. Madame de Pompadour, the official mistress of the French King Louis XV, is supposed to have once declared, "Champagne is the only wine that leaves a woman still beautiful after drinking it." And it's believed that women are more likely to drink bubbly than men do. But what about making it rather than drinking it, and of course still looking beautiful? Juliet Ricks has been finding out that things are changing.
I'm sitting in a contemporary stripped wood conservatory, looking out at a much more traditional view. Beyond a gentle slope, neatly striped with perfect vines, stands a fairy tale French chateau, its decorative creamy facade topped with turrets and spires. It was built by Widow Clicquot, Veuve Clicquot in French, a name far more closely associated with famous champagne than with an actual woman. But she was very real, and in 1805, when she was just 27, her winemaker husband died, and against all early 19th century expectations and considerable opposition, the young widow took over his winemaking business. Adapting and improving it, she spread its effervescent product across the globe, turning it into one of the most successful maisons de champagne. Clicquot was the first female champagne producer. A few more followed. All were widows, the only women French society of the time would allow to take such a public role. They did a remarkably good job. In fact, the Champagne Widows were so successful that some champagne houses without a widow added veuve to their labels nonetheless. But this was not exactly a female takeover. It was just a handful of women all there, as it were, by accident. Most champagne production remained firmly in the hands of men. Until now. Sitting with me at one of the conservatory's narrow, polished tree-trunk tables is Charlotte Le Gallais. Her great-great-grandfather, an Armenian diamond merchant, bought the turreted Clicquot Chateau and the domain surrounding it nearly a century ago. Five generations later, it is not the son, but the daughter, who is taking over the champagne-making. She's part of a new wave of women making significant inroads not only into the selling of the wine, but into the growing and blending, the fundamentals of the creation of champagne. There are now three organisations specifically for women working in the business, and 60% of the students studying winemaking in Champagne are female. So does it make a difference if champagne is made by women? Of course, laughs Françoise Peretti, director of the Champagne Bureau UK. Women are more intuitive and more attentive to aroma and taste, and maybe more curious, more daring. Other leading women in the industry agree. There is love between women and champagne, declares Florène Esnac, one of the few female cellar masters in the big champagne houses. Champagne was first bought for the mistresses of the kings of France, and even today, she continues, to seduce a woman, a man wouldn't buy red wine. He would buy champagne. And it must be said that Esnac is no bubbly, girly type. Her first choice of career was fighter pilot. Only having failed to do that did she turn to making champagne. Charlotte Le Gallais makes no claims to superiority over male champagne makers, but as she shows me the shiny silver tanks that receive the juice pressed from her grapes and carefully explains the details of the highly regulated production method, she does reveal that her favourite part of the process is the blending. The repeated mixing and tasting of wines from different grapes, soils and years to find just the right combination of flavours. The rise of women winemakers will certainly change champagne, says Esnac, though exactly how is yet to be seen. Even blends created today will not be on the market for another 4 or 5 years, and the number of women involved is still rising. Le Gallais points up at one of the towers of Clicquot's chateau. That was her room, she says. It's empty now, though still well cared for. The Le Gallais family moved out of the chateau during the Second World War and now occupy the 16th century manor house across the vineyard that the Clicquots used for the servants. The manor house is unheated, hard on the people, but perfect for the bottles of champagne laid in neat racks in the cellar. Back in the warm conservatory, I raise a sparkling glass of Le Gallais' golden bubbly to my lips and have to agree that this woman makes excellent champagne.
Juliet Ricks, ending on a very agreeable note for a summer weekend. And that's all from us today. We'll be back with more tales from our correspondents next week on Thursday and Saturday. Do join us. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of From Our Own Correspondent. It was presented by Kate Adey and produced by me, Joe Kent. And before you go, we just wanted to let you know about another podcast we thought you might be interested in. Here's the BBC's Middle East editor to tell you all about it.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Bowen, and I'd like to invite you to download my new series about the Middle East. I've been reporting from the region for more than a quarter of a century, and BBC Radio 4 has asked me to reflect on the major events I've covered in that time and to recount some personal stories and experiences. You can listen on the Radio 4 website and in the iPlayer Radio app. Or there's a free podcast you can subscribe to if you prefer. The series is called Our Man in the Middle East. There are more details on the Radio 4 website.